We tend to think of crimes as happening at night, when criminals are less visible and their actions are hidden by shadows. We might jump out of bed when hearing a bump in the night, but that same sound would be ignored during the light of day. Humans, by nature, are more vigilant during the evenings, more likely to be alert to suspicious sounds and shifting shadows. We are afraid of what we cannot see, and so we set our alarms at night, double-check that our doors are locked, or perhaps slip keys between our fingers to use as makeshift weapons as we walk to our cars. And when we wake in the morning, we open doors to let dogs in and out. We ignore thuds and bumps, assuming them to be just sounds of the world around us, getting ready to greet the day. We preoccupy our minds with busy schedules and our ears with podcasts, radios, or the morning news. We let our guards down, only to raise them again when night falls. But there is no rule that says crime cannot occur during the day. No law of nature preventing murder while the sun shines. And perhaps there are bad guys who prefer to hunt during the day, precisely because they know it will be less expected. Perhaps there are some crimes that are more easily committed in broad daylight when their victims are surrounded by people. When 35-year-old Elsie Lee Hilaire woke on that mundane Thursday morning, March 15, 1917, she felt safe as she saw her husband off to work and slipped on her gray suit and various pieces of jewelry. She felt secure as she had breakfast with her niece and talked about her plans for the day. She might have felt nervous or perhaps exhilarated when she took the subway from Brooklyn to Manhattan. Or she might have been feeling guilty, but she was not afraid when she met her date at an Italian restaurant at around noon in perhaps the busiest city in the world. And yet, Elsie Hilaire had already been murdered before night fell. Her lifeless body had already been abandoned before the sun had set. I'm your host, Elise, and this is episode 15 of the historical true crime podcast, Old Blood. The year 1917 was a year of war. The Great War, the war of U-boats and merchant ships, a war against the old orders, the Russian monarchy and the Ottoman Empire, a Mexican Revolution, an American declaration of war against Germany, the Balfour Declaration and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a war of old versus new, of tradition versus modernity. Nowhere represented the rise of modernity and this battle between convention and progress better than New York City. In American history, this period is known as the Progressive Era because of the many reforms made to ensure health, safety, equality, and security for its citizens. And despite all the progress that had been made, New York City remained a hotbed for discontent. The city seethed with citizens angry at how their country had both changed too much and not changed enough. In 1917, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, held a silent protest parade down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, in which 10,000 people, mostly African Americans, marched against police brutality. That June, police armed with rifles marched through Madison Square Garden, trying to root out anarchists and socialists who were meeting to protest the draft for World War I. In February, mobs of mostly women rioted against the rising prices of food due to World War I. And women, too, battled inequality. In San Francisco, female prostitutes fought arrests and the closure of brothels, arguing that for many impoverished women, prostitution was their only means of supporting themselves and their families. Other jobs for women paid extremely low, while the better jobs were reserved for men. But not all women had husbands or male relatives who earned enough to support them and their families. At the beginning of the year, women picketed in front of the White House, demanding the right to vote. Suffragists across the U.S. were arrested and thrown in prison where they went on hunger strikes. In one particularly brutal event, known as the Night of Terror, prison guards attacked suffragists in the workhouse and kicked, punched, dragged, and choked them. All American women would not earn the right to vote until 1920, but by 1917, women in New York, at least, had earned that right. But that did not change female New Yorkers' daily lives in any significant way. It was not until Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, was published in the 1960s that people began to seriously discuss how unfulfilled and unhappy many women felt. But 1917, New York, had provided unsatisfied women with a temporary escape from the confines of their marriages and the monotony of their daily lives. These escapes came in the form of the tango, a South American dance that made its way to New York City and exploded in popularity. Tango bars popped up throughout Manhattan cafes and hotels. Unlike other dances of the day, the tango was personal, body against body. It was a dance of passion, and thus it was a dance of immorality. In 1914, the state of Massachusetts tried to make dancing the tango a criminal act, with penalties of $50 for a first offense and jail time in others. And in Boston, police patrolled dance halls to shut any tangoing down and revoke the licenses of establishments who allowed it. While the tango craze raged, so did its opponents, who believed it far too sensual for decent women to take part in, and believed that women ought to be in the home anyway, caring for their children and husbands, and certainly not sneaking around, lying, and socializing with strange men. But many women were sick of staying at home. They resented the fact that their lives' greatest achievements were simply getting married and procreating, and they hated that they experienced so little of the world around them. Every day was the same as the last, and their lives had transformed into a blur of housework and submission. Women tired of spending their lives within the confines of the same walls, day in and day out. For many women, their introduction to the world of tango began with a shopping trip. Perhaps they left their homes in one of New York's outer boroughs when their husbands departed for work and took the train into Manhattan and into their favorite shops. And by the time they finished shopping, it was about noon. Their stomachs were growling and they had a lengthy trip back home, so they decided to check out one of the ritzy Manhattan cafes for a bite to eat. What they found inside was so much more than food. They found women dancing, sweating, swaying through the air in the arms of a handsome stranger, pressed against him in ways that were previously only seen in the bedroom. These women were alive and glowing with a happiness that only a free woman could experience. And so these women's hunger transformed from a craving for food to a yearning for the life of a tango woman. The next time their husbands left for work, they rushed to complete their housework and then decked themselves out in their finest clothes and jewelry and hopped on the subway. Some of the most popular tango spots were the Café des Beaux-Arts and the ballroom at the famous Biltmore Hotel. They danced, they drank, they socialized, and they made their way back home before their husbands returned from work, wondering what would be for dinner that evening. By day, these women lived secret lives, and by nightfall, they were once again good wives. A former assistant for the New York District of Justice said, "Lunchtime is the great moment of initiation for evil." These were stereotypically middle-aged women who were married with children, but often it was also the daughters who frequented the dance halls. Eugenia Kelly, the 20-year-old daughter of a wealthy banking family, discovered the tango in 1915. The New York Times journalist Will Grimes wrote of Eugenia's social life, explaining how she would freak her parents out by staying out all night. Quote, "She told me a girl was no good in New York City these days unless she went to at least five cafes every night." End quote. Eugenia Kelly smoked, Grimes wrote. She drank absinthe, champagne, and white mint frappes. She danced until dawn. This was all alarming for her parents, but they only truly became concerned when their daughter fell in love with Al Davis. Al was known as a tango pirate. Others might have called him a lounge lizard, a parlor snake, or perhaps a tea hound. Others just called them social parasites. By the way, I found that lounge lizards, tango pirates, and parlor snakes are all band names, and as far as I know, Tea Hound is still up for grabs, just in case any of you are looking for a good band name. Whatever you might choose to call them, they were all essentially the same thing, men who preyed upon the naive women of these tango halls. Because it takes two to tango, after all. Someone has to be dancing with all these women. A surprising number of dance venues actually hired men to escort women around their establishments. These professional male dancers usually received a flat rate salary of about $1.50 a day, though they could receive tips. A 1917 article of the Milwaukee Journal claimed that these tips sometimes amounted to more than a week's salary. Other establishments did not allow tipping and instead gave these escorts a percentage of the amount the woman they danced with spent, which encouraged the men to make the women happy enough to want to stay longer and share some drinks and food. And they were allowed to consume any food or drink a woman purchased for them. In many cases, these truly were professionals, who allowed women to have a good time while still feeling as though the hotel or restaurant was ensuring their safety. But a woman could also be unfortunate enough to encounter a tango pirate, a man who targeted wealthy and naive women, danced with them, charmed them, whispered sweet nothings into their ears. He paid the bill, and the women became so enamored with him and had such a great time that they arranged for another date. Except on the next date, the tango pirate forgot his wallet at home. He was so embarrassed and sorry that the woman consoled him and told him not to worry, that she is happy to cover it. He swears to pay her back and treat her to another day out on the town, and she was so delighted that he wants to see her again that she forgot all about the missing wallet. Of course, he did not mention the money he owed when they met next, and she thought it too improper to bring up and felt so awkward when the next bill arrived and he made no move for it that she just paid it without saying a word. She imagined that he was just lost in his thoughts, and that's why he didn't notice the bill. Or perhaps he was having a hard time financially and was too embarrassed to tell her. Anyway, he was such a sweet and thoughtful man, so quick with the flattering words, that she really didn't mind. Other tango pirates might not put in this much effort. They might be gentlemanly all the way up until the point that he found something to blackmail her with, and then he extorted from her whatever he could. Some fished valuables out of their dates' purses, some stole jewelry right off the women while they were too preoccupied with their elaborate dance moves. Some lounge lizards loved to introduce their dates to drugs, like cocaine or heroin, and then stole from them while they were intoxicated. All tango pirates are well-groomed, handsomely dressed, great dancers, and have the look of money, despite them all usually being unemployed. And unlike many other sleazy men, they weren't after sex, necessarily. Some of these men actually preferred not to be intimate with rich young women, because they didn't want to break their ties to their money supply, which was their family, as the author Mark Knowles explained. As Grimes said, the tango pirate was after money, not sex, unless sex was required to get the money. Like many other tango pirates, Al Davis was already a married man when Eugenia Kelly fell in love with him and began bestowing him with expensive gifts and jewelry. When her parents became aware, possibly after reading one of the many newspaper articles warning parents of such con men, Eugenia's mother forbade her from seeing Al. Eugenia ignored her mother, who then went to the courts, according to Mark Knowles, and asked them to have her declared incorrigible. And when Mrs. Kelly could not get Eugenia remanded to her care, she asked the police to have her arrested, which they did. And after a 3-day battle with Eugenia, she finally relented and admitted that her mother was right, that she was sorry, that she was, quote, dazzled by the glamour of the white lights and the music and the dancing of Broadway, end quote. But Eugenia was not really sorry. She just did not want to miss out on her $10 million inheritance. And so the charges were dropped and Eugenia ran back to Al. Mrs. Kelly freaked out again, tried to have her lawyer keep Al from her daughter by legal means, and when she couldn't, she took Eugenia to a resort on the opposite side of the country. When Al followed them there, Mrs. Kelly took Eugenia back to New York, where Al again followed them. Recently divorced, Al and Eugenia eloped and later had a daughter before divorcing several years later in 1922. Eugenia received her inheritance anyway. Of course, this was all highly publicized. The saga of Eugenia Kelly and the Tango Pirate captured New York's attention. Moral crusaders continued their campaign to eradicate Manhattan of its dance halls and their lounge lizards. And they were quite easy to spot in their brightly colored, gaudy clothing, almost as though they were peacocks with their feathers on display. The New York Times commented on the typical Tango Pirate fashion, listing their silk hats tilted at a 45-degree angle and their spike-tailed cutaway coats. And spats. Always spats, the New York Times said. I have seen 50 of them and never one without spats. For those who don't know, spats are those pieces of fabric that go over the top of men's shoes. They were originally meant for men in the military so that mud and rain and whatever wouldn't get inside their shoes, but by 1917 had become simply a fashion statement. Tango pirates neatly parted their hair, which they slicked back, and donned tightly fitting trousers. And of course, they wore any jewelry that made them appear wealthy, partly to attract a mate with her shiny objects, but also to make a statement. Like, hey, I don't need to steal anyone's money. I've got my own. Obviously, people were not buying it. The Milwaukee Journal warned its readers, quote, under dank stones covered with fetid mosses and beneath decaying logs, the wood lizard is born. In the cloying warmth of the New York tango parlors, with its sickish sweet atmosphere, another variety of lizard has its habitat, the lounge lizard, also a repulsive reptile. Many within the city tried to have New York's dancing scenes shut down, including the popular Café des Beaux-Arts, owned by André Bustanobi, who defended dancing venues as essential for women's health, which might have been a good point if he had said that women need to get out and about for their mental health. But he instead said that women sit idle too much and eat too much cake, so they need to be dancing to burn off the calories. But there was not much that the police could do anyway, even if they encountered a tango pirate before them. As one cop said, you can't arrest a man because he wears brightly colored clothes. Elsie Cavan was born in 1882 to George and Jan Cavan from Jersey City, New Jersey. She was only 18 when she married the 27-year-old Henry James Hilaire and moved to New York with him. Not too much is known about Henry, and I have no photographs of him, but an 1894 passport application described him as being 5'10", having brown hair and brown eyes, a pointed chin, large mouth, and broad forehead. His family was well off enough to live in New York City with an Irish servant. Because I love reading all these old-timey occupations, I felt that I should mention that Henry's French-born father listed himself as a tortoise shells dealer in the 1880 census. Henry did quite well for himself with the perfumery he owned. He and Elsie lived in Manhattan, also with an Irish servant. His business at this time was doing well enough for him to shower his young wife with expensive jewelry to match her 2.5-carat gold diamond engagement ring, which he had inscribed with her initials. In 1902, Henry posted an advertisement in the New York Tribune looking to buy a property in Brooklyn, though we know from the 1905 census that the couple still lived in Manhattan several years later, so the Brooklyn property might have been just an investment. But sometime between then and 1910, Henry's wealth began to dwindle, to the point where the Hilaires were forced to downsize and move to Brooklyn. Land records show she sold a property in White Plains, New York in 1907, and I wonder if this was to help her husband with his financial burdens. Still, they lived in a nice neighborhood, and though Henry was no longer able to shower Elsie with diamonds with his current job as a furniture salesman in a department store, she still wore expensive clothing and furs and lived a comfortable lifestyle. By 1917, Elsie was 35, and she had been married to Henry for 18 years, more than half of her life. It isn't a stretch to imagine that she, too, felt dissatisfied with her life, much as many other women did. Though she and Henry had been able to travel some, she might still have felt as though she had not been able to experience enough of life as she wished, since she married so young. And the couple had no children, though it is uncertain why. It's possible that they were unable to conceive, and this too plagued Elsie, who was looking for more meaning to her life. The Hilaires also lived with Henry's young niece, Irene Murray, who stayed with them off and on since she was 5 years old. But by 1917, Irene Murray was 21. Irene and Elsie had clearly bonded over the years, close enough for Elsie to confide in her and trust her not to spill her secrets to Henry. Because several years earlier, Elsie discovered the wonderful world of tango and ritzy cafes, Broadway music halls, and vaudeville shows. She saw her husband off to work and went to Manhattan during the days, often with Irene by her side, and then returned home before her husband. On the occasions she wished to stay out all night, she would simply tell her husband that she was going to visit her mother, and that she would stay the night and return the next day. Several weeks earlier, Elsie took Irene to the Orpheum Theater to see a vaudeville show. Elsie was decked out in all of her jewelry, as always. She was not a beautiful woman, but she was attractive, if not for her blonde hair and her vivacious personality, and for how immaculately dressed she always seemed to be. And so when Elsie and Irene took a seat in their box at the theater, Elsie caught the attention of a younger man who shared their box. The man caught their eyes too, particularly Irene's, though not necessarily because she thought him attractive. Irene just could not stop staring at the massive diamond pinky ring he wore because it was just so gaudy and distasteful. Elsie kept exchanging glances and smiles with the man, and when Elsie got up during the performance and walked to the back of the theater, he followed her. Irene continued watching the show while peering behind her occasionally to see her aunt and the man flirting with each other. They soon returned to their seats and watched the performance, and did not interact again until he smiled at her on the way out of the theater. Elsie met the man, Irene later learned his name was Benny, several times over the next few weeks. On Thursday, March 15th, Irene entered Elsie's bedroom at around 9:30 in the morning, noting her elaborate outfit of a dress with a beaver collar and cuffs, large black hat, gray shoes, and stockings to match her dress, and a black sealskin stole. As always, Elsie had on all of her jewelry, including several rings and a long pendant necklace with pearls and a large brown stone surrounded by diamonds. She told Irene that she had an appointment to meet Benny again, but around an hour later, Irene received a phone call from Elsie, who said that Benny hadn't showed, so she returned back home and the two women laughed about Benny standing her up while they shared the strangest breakfast I've ever heard of, steak, macaroni with tomato sauce, some bread rolls, and coffee. Shortly after putting away breakfast, Irene went into her room and Elsie went downstairs to answer a phone call. She told Irene that it was Benny, that they were going to meet again, and at around 11:30, Elsie grabbed her blue beaded purse and left the apartment. The following day, Salome Petit, a maid for the Martinique Hotel on 32nd and Broadway, got to work. The Martinique is now one of the oldest hotels in Manhattan. It was originally intended to be an apartment building, but the owner realized that with the boom in theaters and popular businesses in the area, the neighborhood needed a hotel more. And so, in 1897, construction on the Martinique began. But when the 12-story hotel was completed, it still wasn't large enough for the demand, and so the hotel expanded in 1901, again in 1907, and yet again in 1910. The elaborate French Renaissance-styled hotel quickly became the center of New York's social scene, and included a large dining room, a Broadway cafe, and even a grill. The hotel was so large that maids like Salome were assigned to particular floors. Salome's was on the 7th floor. At 8 in the morning, Salome opened the door to room 726. When she looked in, there were still clothes hung on the furniture and doors throughout the room. Because the bed was around a corner and her view of the rest of the room was blocked, Salome backed out and closed the door, thinking that the room was occupied and the guest was likely still asleep. She looked into the room the day before, too, at around 1:30 in the afternoon, to make sure that everything was clean for the next occupant, but she found the room already occupied. A purse sat on the dresser, but she did not see or hear anyone, so she thought that maybe the guest was in the bathroom or just had stepped out for a bit. Salome returned to room 726 once more at 9:45. She knocked on the door, but received no response. Something about the situation was a bit strange, so she used her key to open the locked door and check it out. When the door opened, she called out asking if anyone was in, but received no reply. She peered into the bathroom first, which she found in complete disarray. Dirty towels sat inside the bathtub, and the bath mat was crumpled and pushed to the side. Then she looked in the sink and found two towels, and saw that the one underneath was covered in spots of blood. Salome bravely left the bathroom and walked toward the bed. At first it looked empty, just a pile of sheets and pillows. But then she came closer and saw a sliver of skin. She lifted up the linen enough to know that there was a woman lying on her side. But then she chickened out and ran out of the room into another housekeeper named Alice Garrison. She told Alice that something had happened in room 726 and she needed help. They called from the doorway just to be sure the woman wasn't just knocked out sleeping. Hearing nothing, Alice approached the bed and pulled back the sheets a bit, finding a pillow lying partially across the woman's face. When she picked up the pillow, the housekeeper saw dried blood around the woman's mouth and soaked into the pillow. The woman was naked. There was another pillow flung across her breast, and her body was spread out on the bed awkwardly. The two girls called down to the office, who then called the hotel's live-in doctor, Henry Lewis. When he got to room 726, several maids were standing around, and the assistant manager arrived soon after. The doctor lifted the pillow off of the woman's head and declared she was dead. And by the looks of it, she had been dead for a number of hours. Dr. Lewis and the assistant manager noticed two upturned glasses on the nightstand, sitting in a tray with spilled dark red liquid. When the assistant manager smelled the syrupy liquid, he said it smelled of port wine. Dr. Lewis instructed everyone not to touch anything in the room and to call the police. Officer Frank Schmidt was nearing the end of his night shift, patrolling several blocks around Broadway, when he noticed a signal coming from the police signal box, which alerted him to a sudden death in the nearby Martinique Hotel. When the officer arrived at the hotel, he was shown into room 726 by Dr. Lewis. The officer lifted the covers off the woman completely, finding her dressed only in some gray stockings and high-laced boots. Her left leg was bent with her knee in the air, and the right leg was spread open. Her left hand rested on her left breast, and her right arm was extended upward above her head. Her head was turned to the right and her chin sunk into a pillow that was covered with her blood. Her blonde hair was still pulled up into a messy braid and pinned to her head. The officer thought to search the room for any other evidence, or perhaps hints that she committed suicide, but found nothing of note. There was some makeup on the dresser, along with the hotel's room key, and her clothes were strewn about the room, hung on different pieces of furniture. He asked the hotel staff how the doors and locks worked, and found that once the door closed, it locked from the outside, so anyone could have exited the room and left the door locked behind them, even if they did not have a key. Upon the coroner's request, Officer Schmidt coordinated the corpse's transportation to the police station, where he met doctors Schultz and Schwartz and watched as they performed the autopsy. By now, they had learned from the Martinique that the woman who checked into that hotel room went by the name Florence Gray and was from Boston. One of the more obvious things the three noticed was the lividity on her body. The blood had pooled down onto her back and the back of her arms and legs, leaving the top of her body quite pale. This told the doctors that she had been left in that position for quite some time after death. Dr. Schultz showed the officer some abrasions on the woman's face, what looked like scratches on her jaw, chin, and around her mouth. And then a 2.5-inch mark across her neck pointed to the cause of death, strangulation. From the looks of the abrasion on the throat, the doctor concluded that she had been strangled by a band of some kind, most likely a folded piece of cloth that had cut into her skin. Newspapers later reported that the murderer was familiar with, quote, the methods of European garroters, end quote, who had the skill of a Parisian Apache, whatever that means. Her face was a deep blue, and her eyeballs appeared more prominent in her head than looked normal. She had burst blood vessels in the whites of her eyes. Schultz noted hemorrhages on her scalp, and when examining the inside of her body, noted further hemorrhages on a bone near her right frontal sinus, in her right middle ear, and behind her right eyeball. Her windpipe was crushed, confirming what he already suspected. The woman was strangled to death and was conscious enough to claw her face and neck as she fought for her life. Examination of her organs further confirmed the theory of asphyxiation by strangulation. An examination of her reproductive organs found traces of semen, proving she had sex before she was murdered, and that it was likely consensual. A chemical analysis of her stomach showed that she had last eaten spaghetti and red wine, which sent the police off to nearby Italian restaurants to inquire about, but came up with nothing. But the contents of her stomach, along with the fact that the victim had developed and then lost rigor mortis, helped to establish the time of death as approximately 3:30 and no later than 7 p.m. She was killed several hours after checking into the hotel, in the middle of the afternoon. The police interviewed other hotel employees to find out more about this Florence Gray from Boston. The clerk in the lobby who checked her in remembered her almost immediately because of her fancy clothes and the diamond ring on her right hand as she went to pay for the room. He knew that she had no luggage with her because he asked the bellboy to give her a hotel night robe, as they always did for guests arriving without luggage. The bellboy also remembered her and the many rings she wore as she held out his 20-cent tip. A chambermaid working on the 7th floor saw the woman leave her room the day before, between 1 and 2 in the afternoon. The guest asked her for directions to the 33rd Street entrance of the hotel, and when the woman returned at around 2:30, she approached the chambermaid again, asking, "Will you please tell me where 726 is? I seem to get mixed up around here, I can't find the number." The maid remembered that the woman seemed a little excited, as though she were in a hurry, and her face was flushed. Meanwhile in Brooklyn, Elsie Hilaire had not returned home. She likely told her husband that she was going to visit her mother and would not be home until the following day. I imagine Irene glancing at the door and listening for the telephone, and then becoming even more nervous when her Uncle Henry returned home from work that Friday evening. But Elsie did not come home. It is unclear if they went to the police that evening or spent a sleepless night waiting to hear a key turn in the door. Perhaps Henry called Elsie's mother and was told that Elsie had not been there at all and never made plans with her to do so. Perhaps Irene read the newspapers Saturday morning and read of a woman found strangled to death at the Martinique Hotel. So Irene and Henry contacted the police at some point, and Irene was forced to admit that her uncle's wife had arranged to go on a date with a man named Benny and was planning to go to the same neighborhood of Manhattan, that a woman was just found dead. So, on Saturday morning, March 17th, Henry and Irene went to the Undertakers, where they identified the body not as Florence Gray of Boston, but as Elsie Lee Hilaire. Benjamin Sternberg was known to most as simply Benny, but he almost always gave Sutton as his last name. The 24-year-old was usually described as having an attractive and friendly face, despite the rest of his body often being described as heavy or very heavy, though he doesn't look that way in photos. He was born in New York City and lived in Brooklyn, like Elsie, but his father immigrated to the city from Russia. When Irene gave police the name Benny along with his description, she must have told them that he looked Italian, because the newspapers printed articles that the police were searching for a dark Italian man named Benny, or perhaps Jimmy. But Benny and the rest of his family were actually Jewish. His father, Israel Sternberg, which, side note, is confusing because some other sources have his name as Morris, or Maurice, or Moses, which all kind of sound the same if you're mumbling. But in a document from 1923, Benny claimed that his parents were dead and that he lived with a relative named Morris, so it's possible that this M-named guy was an uncle or something. Either way, I'm going to stick with Israel as his dad's name, which is what the papers mostly use. Anyway, Israel Sternberg is either a fur manufacturer or simply has a store that sells furs. By Elsie's murder in 1917, Benny is unemployed, though he claims to be a fur dealer and works on behalf of his dad's store and another store called Cohn Brothers. Benny also sees the newspapers and reads that the police are looking for a Benny with his physical description. He claims to have walked himself to the police station, saying something like, "I'm Benny." But it's also possible that other people who knew him, including some cops, called up the detectives in charge of the case and said that they knew who Benny was. Officer Herman Scheiser, who worked at the Coney Island precinct, remembered seeing Benny on the train the Thursday that Elsie was killed. When Scheiser went to identify him at the station, Benny pretended not to recognize him, despite the fact that the officer had known him for about 4 years and regularly saw him at various theaters and on the trains. When he saw Benny that Thursday, the first thing he said to him was, "Jesus, you look pretty well dressed up. You ain't in want of anything." Benny replied, saying, "I am going to meet a big blonde dame this afternoon and spend time in New York," meaning Manhattan. Because, of course, when you're in New York and say New York, you really only mean the city, and it's also the city, as though it were the only one in the world that matters. The New York Sun wrote that Benny bragged to the officer about how he was going to meet a swell chicken. You gotta love these old-timey sayings. Scheiser, Benny, and two others talked during the ride, joking around about women, because, according to the officer, "I know he is a chicken chaser," and had regularly seen him with women other than his wife. Because, yes, he was married, and he had a 3-month-old son at home. When pressed for details about his conversation with Benny, the officer said that Benny kept talking about jewelry. He said Benny pointed to his own massive pinky ring, saying it cost $500, which was a hell of a lot more back then. Streisser said that Benny's ring was, quote, such a big one that it would attract anyone's attention. It was on his pinky, and he wasn't afraid to let you see it. He almost put it up to your face so that you couldn't help noticing it. He is a pretty natty sort of fellow, the officer said. Silk shirts and all that. But he knew Benny wasn't working. When Officer Scheisser got on the train to Coney Island, he watched Benny walk over to buy a subway ticket, and then didn't see him again until he was asked to identify him at the 2nd Branch Detective Bureau. And, yes, they did have subways in New York in 1917. I was a little surprised to learn that, too. When detectives brought Benny to the Hilaire home for Irene to identify him, she became hysterical. Yes, Irene said in tears, that is the man who met my aunt. He is the one. He is the one she told me she was to meet last Thursday. Benny wasn't as slick as he thought he was, and Elsie didn't exactly camouflage into her surroundings, and so quite a few people noticed them. Two women on the subway were having a conversation about tango pirates, and how dangerous it had become for women when Benny and Elsie walked in. One woman turned to the other, saying basically, look, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Elsie was obviously at least a decade older than the flamboyantly dressed man, who the woman described as the young dancing type. The two women remembered seeing Elsie and Benny vividly because of how coincidental it was for the stereotypical tango couple to walk in right as they were talking about them. Another woman also saw them on the train, and they stuck in her mind because of what an unusual couple they were, with the woman looking 10 years older, but still a, quote, striking blonde, end quote. She remembered worrying about the woman because she did not have a coat with her and it was cold. Benny stuck out because of his massive pinky ring. She described him as, quote, very thick-set. I should call him chunky, broad shoulders, and he had very little neck, end quote. When they were out of earshot, the woman turned to her friend and asked if she noticed them too. Her friend agreed that they were, quote, a peculiar-looking couple, so wholly unmated, end quote. A stenographer and a lawyer in a different state was walking along Broadway when he noticed an oddly matched couple walking together. He said the man had just one of those faces that was very distinct and easy to remember, along with the fact that he had an unusual gait, sort of clumsy, and he thought it might have been because he was a very heavy-built man. The woman was striking, too, because she obviously came from money. The man had the odd sensation that something was off about the couple, so he followed them down Broadway as they turned onto 32nd Street and walked into the Martinique. He stood in the lobby for a bit, just watching them, but when he went to order a drink, the couple disappeared. It was around 3:40 in the afternoon. When detectives first questioned Benny, he told them that he had no idea who this murdered woman was, had never met her at a hotel, and that he never went to the Martinique that Thursday, that he wasn't even in Manhattan because he was hanging out in Brooklyn cafes all day, and gave the police some names of them. Detectives visited these cafes and interviewed the employees, and none of them ever remembered seeing Benny there that day. Louis Mertz, owner of Mertz's Cafe, told the police he knew Benny pretty well for the past 6 or 7 months because he was a regular. Neither he nor the bartender, who also knew who Benny was, saw him that Thursday. When asked if it was possible that they just didn't see him come in, they said no because of the cafe's layout. The bar was shaped sort of like a triangle, so they were able to see all of their customers. There weren't any blind spots. Benny's friend Billy was at these cafes in the late afternoon and didn't see Benny there until 7 p.m. at the earliest, when he walked in with a huge wad of cash. But the real break in the case came when the woman on the train and the stenographer walking down Broadway read in the papers about the murdered woman, whose description matched their memories. The stenographer saw Elsie's photo in the papers and called the police as a matter of common justice. The police asked him to pick Benny out of a crowd of men and the man identified him immediately. When the women also identified Benny, they questioned him again and told Benny that they had several witnesses who had all positively identified him as the man they saw with Elsie Hilaire the day she was murdered. So Benny changed his story. While calm and cool earlier, Benny became uncomfortable and couldn't decide whether he wanted to stand or sit, so he alternated between the two while telling police that, yeah, he had been with Elsie and had met her before. He was with her at Grand Central Station on Thursday, but then she ran into some other guy there and then told Benny that she couldn't keep their date because she had to go off with the other guy. Obviously, the police were not buying this, but they had limited evidence to work with. They called a fingerprint team into the hotel room, but this resulted in nothing. Nothing was missing from the room. All the towels and sheets were accounted for, so they kept searching for the murder weapon, which they knew was a folded cord of cloth. According to the newspapers, the cops were quite interested to find 6 pieces of a tie hidden on Benny's body when he was at the station. The bright green tie matched the one he was spotted wearing on the day of the murder, but it seems Benny had cut it up into many different pieces. Was he trying to destroy evidence? Whatever Elsie was strangled with cut into the tender skin on her throat, so I assume that it would have traces of blood on it that detectives would have seen and used as evidence. Also, Benny was not taken into the station immediately after her murder. We know that police were trying to figure out who the murdered woman was at first, and then were searching for him. It seems unlikely that Benny would keep evidence of a murder on him for days afterward. Even if he forgot to get rid of a tie that he used to kill someone, wouldn't he have changed clothes between Thursday and the weekend? The New York Times printed that while Benny was stuck at the station, he gave the police some money and asked them to go buy a new tie for him since the one he had was dirty. They did, so he took his old tie off and the detective grabbed it and said, quote, "A Jew had no business with a green tie," end quote, and then cut it to pieces with a penknife. An unusual story, and it doesn't explain why it would be hidden on different parts of his body. I tend to think the entire green tie clue is a red herring, or a green herring. One thing the police were sure of was that Elsie Hilaire left her home with a ton of jewelry, and when she was found murdered, it was gone. Detectives were positive that the key to solving this case and ensuring a conviction was through locating the missing jewelry. They checked all the local pawn shops and found nothing, and searched all the locations they believe Benny might have hidden the jewelry, so they assumed that the jewelry had either been hidden somewhere or sold on the black market to someone who knew they were stolen and didn't care. The police were having such a hard time finding the jewelry that the mayor recommended a $1,000 reward for information leading to them or their thief. The Board of Aldermen released a description of the 7 articles of jewelry. Missing were an emerald pendant adorned with pearls and diamonds, a topaz breast pin in a leaf setting that held 35 quarter-carat diamonds, a brown diamond dinner ring set amongst smaller diamonds, 1 2.5-carat diamond ring with 3 half-carat diamonds on each side, 2 pinky rings of an emerald and diamonds, and 1 2.5-carat solitaire gold engagement ring, with an inscription reading HJH2ELC, November 9th, 1899. And then there were other green herrings. The police received a letter from a woman saying that they absolutely had the right man. She said that Benny approached her boss asking if he could help him get rid of some jewels quickly, but she sent the letter anonymously because she didn't want to lose her job. Detectives unsuccessfully tried to track her down, and even Benny told the New York Times that he wished the woman would come forward. He pleaded for her to make herself known, saying that a man's life is worth more than a job. Nothing more came of this letter. In all likelihood, it was just someone messing around, and even if Benny was guilty of the murder, he might have known that he didn't dispose of the jewels that way, so he publicly asked his accuser to come forth, knowing that it would make him look more innocent. And then the papers began speculating about a big blonde that was supposedly with Benny when Irene and Elsie met him at the Orpheum, and who was allegedly with Benny on the day of the murder, and in a hotel room close to Elsie's at the Martinique. Newspapers said the police were chasing this lead, but the blonde was never mentioned in trial transcripts, not even when Irene described in detail their first meeting Benny. And yet another red herring swam in when a maid at the Martinique went to the police days after Elsie's body was found, claiming that she was cleaning a room on the other side of the hall of Elsie's room when she found a note that was signed Florence Gray. Supposedly, two men rented the room and the letter was sent to them, asking them if they could help her get a job at a cabaret. The Times claimed that the maid wasn't absolutely sure of the spelling, so does that mean she did not even have the letter? In any case, this remained hearsay, as did most of the prosecution's case against Benny. All of their evidence was based upon witness testimony and a phone call to the Hilaire apartment traced to Brooklyn, where Benny also lived, but with no specifics as to where. But the police were still convinced as ever that Benny was their guy. Their witnesses were credible, and they had all easily picked Benny out of a lineup. And Benny himself convinced them with his ever-changing alibis. First, he had never even met Elsie, and then he had a date with her, but then got ditched at Grand Central. And he kept changing his story about what exit he took to get off of the subway in Manhattan. At one point, he said he exited on 50th Street, and the prosecutor, just to mess with him and see if his story would change, asked how he could exit on 50th Street when that exit was blown up the week before. And sure enough, Benny changed his story again, saying that he messed up. He must have exited at Times Square. He just knew that he exited two stations after Grand Central. Less than a week after Elsie was murdered, the coroner ordered that Benny be brought in for an inquest. Benny had hired a lawyer at this point, who was enraged at the detective's treatment of his client. He tried to get Benny out of the police station, but was told that they couldn't give him Benny because Benny was there talking to them voluntarily. So his lawyer brought in a writ of habeas corpus, which ordered the authorities into court to prove that keeping Benny in custody was legal. His lawyer later claimed that the police essentially tortured him, giving him only 3 glasses of water and no food in almost 2 days he was there, and firing questions at him nonstop and keeping him awake, waking him up every time he dozed off. One paper quoted Benny telling detectives, "I did not go with Mrs. Hilaire to the hotel, and all your bulldozing and questioning cannot make me say I did. You can ask all the questions you please, bring all the witnesses you want to, but you can't prove I did it because I didn't." I, for one, would like to know how the press heard Benny with such detail while he was supposedly hidden away in the police station. Eventually, Benny's lawyer got him out of the detective's bureau, but it was only a matter of time before he was hauled in front of the coroner for his inquest. When the police arrived at Benny's house to bring him into custody and before the coroner, Benny and his dad began weeping. By this time, anywhere that Benny was turned into a media circus, with crowds fighting to get a good look at the Tango Pirate. And so when the police tried to put Benny into the police van, crowds blocked Benny's dad as he struggled to get to his son, shouting, "My son! They are trying to murder my son!" Israel Sternberg finally threw his arms around his son, who cried, "Father, don't let them kill me!" Israel kept reaching for his son and yelling at the police as they dragged Benny to the van. Benny begged them to be gentle with his dad since he was old, but Israel kept swinging his cane at the cops, so they grabbed him, threw him to the floor, and held him down on the pavement. Israel somehow got free and then threw himself in front of the van and onto the hood of the car and clutching the radiator, according to one source. Israel cried that they couldn't take his son without killing him first. Benny wept. "Oh, Papa, they're trying to make a reputation. They're going to try to kill me, but you know I am innocent." The press loved this little drama. Benny's attorney said that the client's elderly father was grabbed, assaulted, and pushed to one side. But the New York Times said, the detectives used no more force than was necessary. What the truth actually was, we will never know. What little I read of Benny's wife, Sophie, had her crying when she first found out what was going on, and saying that she never dreamed Benny would meet another woman. The New York Times said that Sophie yelled at her husband, saying, "Why didn't you tell me? I never thought you went out with other women." But I'm not sure how the Times would know that she said such a thing, unless she screamed it in public. Sophie was later seen with Israel, both crying and both insisting that Benny was innocent. Elsie's family was obviously not doing well, either. The detectives called the Hilaire home looking to speak to Henry, but a middle-aged friend of the family answered the phone and told them that Henry went to Manhattan to plan the funeral. Irene was, quote, in a hysterical condition and could not be seen, end quote. So the police returned to the Hilaire's apartment four or five more times, trying to speak with either Henry or Irene, but kept being refused. Finally, the friend of the family snapped at them, asking, "Why are you so persistent? We cannot help you." It seems they wanted information about Elsie's jewelry so that they could help return it to the family, because the women asked, "What do we want with the jewelry? There is no one to wear it now." Henry said that he never wanted to look at the jewels again. The coroner told police that they only had 24 hours to hold Benny unless they discovered more evidence. Benny's lawyers asked that he be taken to the Tombs, a Manhattan jail, instead of the police station because of how horribly they treated him there. At one point, Benny asked to have all the newspapers brought to him so that he could read about the case. He read through them with glee, apparently happy for all of the publicity because he smiled and laughed through them all, and joked about how funny it was that the papers called him a tango pirate. The prosecutor fought to keep Benny in custody, telling the coroner, "If you permit this man Sternberg to go free on bail, you will never see him again. I tell you, he will either do the Dutch and commit suicide, or he will disappear. This man will not be seen again if he gets bail." When the coroner released him on bail anyway, Benny's wife began crying and kissing the coroner's hand as she thanked him. Once free, Benny ran through the crowd to hug his dad and wife. At one point, Benny told the New York Sun, "I was a Sabbath school scholar when I was a boy, and I wish I had continued to be one. Then I would never have gotten into this jam, although I am innocent of any connection with the murder. I am very sorry for the life I have led, and I hope that the people who read the stories of this case in the newspapers will see a moral and act accordingly." Which sounds sort of like he was confessing to be a tango pirate, even though he also went around saying that he was not, and even that he couldn't be Elsie's killer, because he wasn't a good dancer. Sure, buddy. Benny made his way before a grand jury, where he wept and said he wasn't afraid of being convicted, because he was innocent. His lawyer reiterated that just because Benny dressed a certain way, and just because he didn't live the most honest life, and just because he was seen with Elsie earlier that day, it did not mean that Benny was the killer. Earlier, Benny told reporters, "They want to blame this crime on me because they have not been able to find anyone else. I am no tango dancer or a lounge lizard." But it was true, the police had no other suspects. Irene gave the detectives the names of several other men that Elsie went out with, but she had stopped seeing them long before her murder, and none of them raised the detective's suspicions when they were interrogated. Benny was their guy, they were sure of it, not just from the witnesses, but from Benny's own seedy life. From Benny being nearly perpetually unemployed, from his involvement in fur sales that he had few records of, and his interest in betting on racehorses. His giant-ass pinky ring that he would not have been able to afford. Hell, even Benny himself said that he wasn't living as pure of a life as he should have been. And yet again, suspicions and witness testimony alone are not enough to convict someone for murder. At least, in this case, it wasn't. Although the coroner sent the case to the grand jury and charged him with first-degree murder, the judge ultimately dismissed the case on the grounds of insufficient evidence and let Benny go free. And apparently, though most of the jurors thought Benny was guilty, one of them thought Elsie might have died of natural causes, which was ridiculous, seeing as she had a crushed windpipe. The judge told the prosecutor that he was welcome to resubmit the case to the grand jury in the event that the state uncovers more evidence. The investigation into the murder of Mrs. Hilaire kicked off a hunt for Tango Pirates throughout New York City. One newspaper reported that the police counted a whopping total of 2,000 Tango Boys throughout the city. As one paper described, sleek, slender, immaculately tailored, pasty-faced, effeminate, and ennuied youths who leech a luxurious livelihood from dance-craved, middle-aged married women who dupe their husbands. Several other newspapers throughout the U.S. printed that of 76 names the police were able to obtain in these lounge lizard stings, 50 of them were former convicts. Towards the end of 1919, Toronto police arrested Benny, believing him responsible for a string of burglaries reported by New York fur stores. One journal reported that the amount lost to be up to $50,000, but the New York Times printed that it was only $15,000 worth of furs that were stolen. I said only $15,000, but that would be about $220,000 today. Benny tried to fight being extradited from Toronto back to the States, but was back in New York by January of 1920. He, along with several cops, were under indictment for stealing furs from the Starobin and Dubin fur store in Brooklyn. The Times claimed Benny gave the district attorney information that would lead to several other Brooklyn thefts as well. The cop at the center of this heist was a Brooklyn patrolman and former Marine who even earned a Commendation of Valor for his involvement in the 1900 Boxer Rebellion in China. The 14-year veteran entered a plea for leniency on account of service, which was denied, and he received a sentence of 7 to 14 years. The district attorney speculated that it was actually this cop, by the name of Krause, that was behind Brooklyn's recent rash of robberies, because they all bore Krause's handiwork. The New York Tribune said that Benny served as paymaster, which I am assuming means he was the middleman who sold or tried to sell the stolen goods and then made sure the right amount of money got back to the right people. And that says something about him. It says that he had connections with people who did not mind paying money for stolen goods, like furs and jewelry. And it also says that Benny had connections with crooked cops who might have helped him out in ways that we can only speculate about. In February of 1920, Benny was admitted into Sing Sing Prison in New York on a 7-year term for grand larceny. His admission papers list him as 26 years old, 5'6", and 145 pounds, so he really couldn't have been as heavy as people said he was. Either that, or he lost a bunch of weight. He listed his occupation as salesman, and whoever admitted him checked the box that said he used drugs. While he was in prison, his wife Sophie filed for divorce. They had only been married for a year when she learned of him having an affair and possibly murdering a woman, so it wasn't exactly a match made in heaven. For whatever reason, Sophie had to travel to Nevada to do so, so she left their son Monroe with her sister. Benny, being Benny, fought Sophie's divorce suit and, despite being in prison, tried to gain custody of Monroe because he would rather his son live with his parents than the boy's own mother. The 5-year-old boy supposedly told the judge that he liked living with his aunt, so the judge allowed it and dismissed the case. But Sophie's battle wasn't over, for she then began battling Benny's parents. Apparently, when Sophie left their home the previous year, her in-laws wouldn't allow her back in to get her things. So she eventually had to sue them for $4,625 worth of her jewelry, clothing, and furniture. Sophie eventually remarried a man who owned a whiskey distillery, where her and Benny's 23-year-old son would later work as well. She died in 1968. And old Benny Boy died in 1952 at the age of 58. I found no cause of death for him because I found no obituary or any sort of memorial. He was buried in the Sternberg family plot without any additional remnants of his life. All that remains of Benny Sternberg are newspaper clippings of his robberies and sleazy behavior, and a trial transcript from the time he strangled a drunk woman to death. Police never solved the case of Elsie's murder. They never found more substantive evidence to charge Benny again for her murder. So far as I know, Elsie's jewelry has still not been found. But the jewelry is still out there, somewhere. Someone has it. Perhaps lying around in an antique shop or in your grandmother's jewelry box. Nothing more is known of Henry Hilaire. He appears in no more newspaper articles, to my knowledge, nor could I find evidence of him ever remarrying. He died in 1930 as he neared 60 years old, only 13 years after his wife was murdered. Irene evidently married and took the last name Nathan. She died in 1970 and was placed in the same Hilaire family plot as Henry and the rest of his family. But Elsie was not buried there. In fact, as hard as I tried to find her, and as long as I searched, I could not find a gravestone or memorial or cemetery, or even an obituary for her. Which leads me to the depressing conclusion that Henry did not want to be buried near his wife after her betrayal, and wherever she was buried, if she was buried at all, it was not important enough for anyone to record. Thank you so much for listening to episode 15. I want to give a shout out to one of the podcast fans named John, who emailed me a couple months ago and let me know about this case and how no one else has covered it. And it was so much fun researching this case. So thank you, John. A list of our sources can be found in the show notes or on our website at oldbloodpodcast.com. There you can also find some great images related to this case, which will also be posted to our Instagram and Facebook, which you can find by searching for Old Blood Podcast. Be sure to come back in 2 weeks for episode 16. Music credits to Shane Ivers at silvermansound.com.